Thank you. I'd like to describe some ongoing work that I've been doing with some of my colleagues in Oxford. Their names are Benjamin Doyon, who's a French-Canadian, and Valentina Riva. This is part of an ongoing sort of effort to try to understand whether we can make a more rigorous formulation of the ideas of conformal field theory inspired by the recent developments using SLE and the various other related ideas that we've been hearing about. So I think that to this audience here, I should spend a few minutes at least explaining some of the ideas of conformal field theory that I want to actually that I'd like to understand how to put on a more rigorous basis. So if we consider conformal field theory in some domain D, you can think of it basically, you can think of a conformal field theory as a set of correlation functions. That's the way I like to think about it. There are, of course, other ways of thinking about it. But these correlation functions are basically maps from n copies of D. That is, we've got various points here, Z1 up to Zn, minus the places where these points come together, and these are maps usually they're complex valued functions. Now, of course, we're not interested in considering all functions. In fact, there is a suggestive notation, and maybe one shouldn't call it any more than that, which comes from physics, that we write these correlation functions as something like expectation values of products of local quantities. So this is the kind of notation that you will see in a physics paper when they're talking about these correlation functions. And the idea is that these brackets here denote some kind of an expectation value. And the problem is, in conformal field theory, to understand really what is the measure that you're talking about here, and also what are these local objects here. And the idea is, from physics, that you start with a lattice, a discrete lattice, where these are discrete objects on the lattice. You have some kind of a Boltzmann measure, some kind of a Gibbs measure, Boltzmann weights on this lattice, where everything is completely well defined. But then you take the scaling limit where the mesh goes to zero, and that is the problem, really, that you don't really understand what this measure then really means and what these objects are. They're referred to in the physics literature as renormalized operators, but the question is, what does this really mean? So the hope is that these recent developments in SLE and so on will perhaps give us a better mathematical foundation for discussing this, because it gives us a very well-defined measure on random curves, on random sets in the plane. The question is then, what are these local operators in terms of those random sets? And when you calculate these expectation values with respect to this well-defined measure, do these objects obey the rules that we expect them to from conformal field theory? And one of these important rules is it tells you how these correlation functions behave as two of these points approach each other. And this is known in field theory in general as the operator product expansion, OPE for short, and it says basically that if I take phi I at the point zi, phi j at the point zj, just take a part of this and I take the limit as this thing gets small, as this distance gets much smaller than any of the other distances in the problem, this can be expressed as a sum over all the other objects, which we've not defined either in the theory, all the other scaling operators in the theory. And what goes in here is basically very simple. These things behave as a power law in the following way: zi minus zj, just write this down, hi minus hj plus hk, zi bar, zj bar to the minus hi bar, minus hj bar plus hk bar. So this goes in here. So as we have these functions here, they aren't defined at the points where at the places where the points actually coincide, but as they approach each other, they have very well-defined power laws which appear, and these powers here are the conformal weights, the so-called conformal weights, which characterize the allowed operators in this theory. And also what comes in here are some universal numbers, C, I, J, K. And in fact, once you know these allowed values of the H's and you know these numbers, you know everything about all the correlation functions of the theory. Now, I've already specialized to two dimensions here. I've specialized to a notation where I label points in the plane by complex numbers, z, and their complex conjugates, z bar. I've introduced these so-called weights, and the notation here is somewhat confusing because these weights, hi and hi bar, are in fact generally real, and they're not complex conjugates of each other necessarily. So hi bar are called the conformal weights of phi I, and the sum of these two tells us how this object transforms under a scale transformation, and it's usually called the scaling dimension. I also want to mention the difference of these two, let's call it SI, because this in the lingo is called the spin of phi I. So this isn't like a quantum mechanical spin, but it tells us how these correlation functions behave when I rotate the entire system. Basically, if I make a rotation, z goes to z e to the I theta, then basically phi I goes to e to the I s I theta phi I. Okay, so that's the so-called spin in conformal field theory. Now, there is one particular operator or object in conformal field theory which is particularly important, and this is called the stress tensor, or occasionally the stress energy tensor, the energy momentum tensor, or just the stress tensor for short. And it's called T. Actually, it's got two components which are called T and T bar in general. Let's just focus on T. T has the property that its correlation functions with other operators are meromorphic functions of Z. And it's this that makes the whole theory, the whole setup very powerful, because of course once you know the singularities of a meromorphic function, then you know everything about it. And in particular, the singularities that occur in this operator product expansion when Z approaches one of these other points are the following. Plus non-singular terms. So by looking at these correlators of T with other objects in the theory, and taking the points close together, we can pull out the conformal weights, this is phi j here, of all the other operators in our theory. This is in fact called the conformal Ward identity, or at least it's one version of it, identity. And basically what it really says when you stick it into a correlation function is that if you take a correlation function here with a single T and a bunch of other operators, then you basically get singularities at, as a function of Z, you get singularities at all these other points. So basically, because the singularities determine the function, this is given explicitly by this formula here, plus 1 over z minus zj d by d zj of the same correlation function without the insertion of t. So this is another form that you see the conformal Ward identity in. Now, the reason that it's called the conformal Ward identity, I don't think I could spend too much time here explaining this, but the fact that these conformal weights occur here is to do with the fact that inserting T and doing contour integrals of this tells you how a particular correlation function transforms under conformal transformations. So So let me actually put that up there and try not to erase it, because that's the equation that we're going to try to reproduce. So what we would like to do within SLE or one of these related models is to make an identification of what is T, and also make an identification of what the other possible observables are in the theory, and to actually show that this conformal water identity holds. Okay. Where am I? And we're actually going to show this in a particularly simple case. Okay, so the questions are, what is the identification of T? What is the identification of, well, at least some of the other operators in the theory? And then to actually derive the conformal water identities once we actually have this. Now, we're going to actually do this in a very simple case when we have what's called, well, since this has been talked about ad nauseam in Wendelin's lectures, I don't have to talk about it anymore. We're going to assume that we have conformal restriction. That is, if we're talking about ordinary SLE, then we're talking about SLE 8/3, or maybe we'd be talking about this measure on single self-avoiding loops, which Wendelin introduced in his lectures. So we're going to actually assume this. Now, actually, this question that I've introduced here, in the case, especially in the case where we have conformal restriction, was in fact already partially answered in a paper of Friedrich and Werner. They showed the following, that if you consider the upper half plane and you consider an SLE 8/3, which starts, say, here and goes to infinity, and you introduce a whole bunch of little vertical slits along the real axis at the points Z1, Z2, etc., and they're of height epsilon1, epsilon2, etc., and you look at the probability of the event that the SLE goes through all of these slits. So we look at the probability that the SLE 8/3 goes through all these slits, and if you scale this, I haven't left myself enough space here. If you scale this suitably, well, obviously this probability goes to zero as the epsilons go to zero. If you scale it with epsilon j to the minus 2, then that actually has a finite limit as the epsilon j's go to zero. And apart from a multiplicative constant, you can identify this with the correlators of a whole bunch of stress tensors at these points. So basically T of Z1, T of Z2, all the way up to T of Zn, with something here which produces the SLE. Let's just call it phi, and also one at infinity, which where the SLE ends. So what you can show, or what they showed using restriction, is that this probability, as a function of these Z1, Z2, etc., obeys the conformal Ward identities in the sense that as, say, Z1 approaches Z2, okay, so as Z1 approaches Z2, you get an equation which relates the correlation function with n of these t's to something over here which has got n minus 1 of them. And what you get in here is precisely the scaling dimension of the stress tensor, which is 2. And the reason that you can use restriction quite easily is that obviously you can relate the probability that this goes through all the slits to the various probabilities that it avoids the slits. And if you think about the probability that it avoids the slits, what you're really looking at is an SLE 8/3 in a domain which is the upper half plane minus the slits, and therefore because of the restriction property you can easily work that thing out, and that's what they did. Which CFT? Well, this corresponds to the conformal field theory, which describes the scaling limit of the ON model with n equals zero, in fact. I'm sorry? So, you've got... So, we can also... I mean, I don't have to tell you which conformal field theory. This is a conformal field theory with central charge zero. I'm not quite sure which answer you're expecting when you... I'm never sure what people are expecting. Am I supposed to say a Western mean know what? Well, it's not any of those. I mean, it doesn't have a Lagrangian. Okay, so... But it's a particular conformal field theory which is believed to exist that describes self-avoiding loops, the kind of self-avoiding loops that Vendelin was discussing, but it's only, so it's supposed to be the scaling limit of what's called the ON model on the lattice in the limit that n, yeah, n goes to zero. So I hope that's a sufficient answer to your question. I'm not sure. I mean, oh, Dejean, yes, okay, yes, of course. Okay, so we would like to generalize this result of Friedrich and Werner to the case where these points, Z and so forth, are not on the boundary but also in the bulk. And we would like to... generalize it to any suitable restriction measure, not just SLE 8/3. But we're obviously inspired by their results. So the obvious thing that one might ask, sticking with an SLE 8/3 just as an example, if one wants to identify the stress tensor in the bulk, it seems reasonable that one should think about putting little slits in the bulk instead of on the boundary. So, for example, one might have three of these or something, and one can ask for the probability, something like this, that this SLE intersects these slits. Notice it might go through them, it might go through them and come back. It probably does lots of very, very complicated things in the neighborhood of this slit. But the question is going to be whether it touches them at all. So we can think about having various slits at points Z1, Z2, Z3, and they're going to be of length epsilon1, epsilon2, epsilon3, and let's think about the probability that the SLE goes through these slits. Now, actually, and then we would like to understand how this scales as epsilon goes to zero. Now, as it stands, actually, what you expect as these epsilon goes to zero is that this basically goes like something that measures the fractal dimension of this object. Because one way that you might measure the fractal dimension is by covering this thing with lots of small disks and counting how many disks it needs as the radius of the disk goes to zero, or alternatively fixing some disk and asking for the probability that the SLE intersects this disk and how this scales with the radius. And in the end, it doesn't really matter whether it's a disk or a slit. You would expect the power to be the same. So this actually does not give us the stress tensor, because we expect for the stress tensor, because it has dimension 2, that this power is going to be 2, just as it was there. But we have to remember that in the bulk, the stress tensor is holomorphic, which means that it has H equals 2, but it has H bar equals 0. It has spin 2. So T has spin 2. So the idea is to take this probability that it goes through these slits, and this probability is going to depend upon the ZJs, it's going to depend upon the epsilon Js, but it's also going to depend on the angles, theta J, that these slits make with some fixed direction. Okay? And the way to get a spin 2 object out of this, an object that behaves correctly under rotations, is clearly to do some integral over the orientations of these slits, but multiply it by e to the minus 2i theta j. So we take a phase factor. So we take the probability that it goes through all of these slits, but then take a particular Fourier component of this with respect to the angles, theta. Sorry? The 2 is the spin. Yeah. Okay. So let's think about that particular object. And then it's a theorem that we've proved up to some modulo a few technical assumptions that let me define this object here when I do this average to be Q, and that's going to depend upon the ZJs and the epsilon Js, and And so if I take this this object and I scale it with epsilon j to the minus 2, it turns out now this object scales like epsilon squared rather than epsilon to the 2 minus df, and there's various constants as well that one can work out, then this limit exists. And in a sense it's the same as t of z1, t of z2, blah blah blah, where this object as a function of the zj's satisfies the conformal Ward identities. So that's the content of our theorem. Before I so if I'm talking about an SLE, a chordal SLE, then I'd better also have a phi of 0, phi of infinity, and it also satisfies the correct condition as, say, z1 approaches 0, in which case I don't get a 2 here, but I get the scaling dimension of this particular operator which creates the SLE. The correct scaling dimension in the case kappa equals 8/3. Excuse me? No, Q isn't real. No. It's a meromorphic function of all the ZJs. It's a Fourier component of this probability with this phases. So in itself it's not a probability. Whilst in this case it was. It was real. Okay? The probability that it goes through the slit depends on the angle. Because well, no. Actually, let me, as an aside, before I show you how the general proof goes, just as an exercise, you can do the following thing with just one slit. Okay, so you start an SLE. In fact, this problem can be worked out for a general value of kappa. You can ask, what is the probability that this chordal SLE from 0 to infinity goes through this slit, which is at the point z, epsilon, and has got an angle theta. Okay, this is an easy problem to do because you use the SLE equation. That is basically, you imagine advancing this for a small time. You use the conformal mapping GT, the Loebner mapping, to actually do this. This maps this point to some other point here. It maps the remainder of this curve to a curve here. It also moves the slit slightly. Moves z slightly, changes epsilon slightly, changes theta slightly. It rotates it a little bit because it's a conformal mapping. So, but you know all of that, and you also know this point undergoes a Brownian motion. So it's easy to work out an equation, a differential equation, for this probability. And the solution, so you can work out this probability, the epsilon beta, you can work out this Fourier component of it, this particular moment of it, and what you can show, so this is once again what I call Q, but now we just have one slit. And you can show that in general, Q of Z goes like epsilon to the 1 plus 3 kappa over 8. Z to the So this is the solution to that differential equation with the smallest exponent here, which is the, so it's the leading term as epsilon approaches zero. So you can prove that that is. Now, so I've done it for a general value of kappa, and you can see now why kappa equals 8/3 when you have restriction is important. It's that's just the case where this thing vanishes and this thing vanishes, and the whole thing is just a function of z and not z bar, so it's holomorphic. So this definition that we're going to use of the stress tensor is only going to work for kappa equals 8/3 for the restriction case, but in that case it is holomorphic as promised, and you can work out then it's OPE. So, but that's just one slit, and we want to work it out in the case of lots of slits. Any questions so far? Okay, so we're going to use restriction, and I think I'll just do it in one example. Instead of talking about chordal SLE, let me apply it to the example that Wendelin has been talking about, that is the measure on self-avoiding loops. So we're going to take a domain, let's take it to the unit circle, just so that stays nice and firm and fixed, and we're going to have these self-avoiding loops, and we're going to have this particular measure that Wendelin's been talking about that satisfies restriction. So the idea is that we're going to have lots and lots of these slits around, but for the time being, I'm just going to focus on one particular slit here. And I'm also going to wonder what are other possible observables that I can think about for this curve. So obvious observables are that I take a bunch of other points, z1, z2, etc., and I ask, does the curve go around these in various ways? So I can fix a whole bunch of points, and for example, an example of an expectation value of an observable that I'd be interested in would be the expectation value that this curve, let's call it gamma goes, so there is going to be some particular event which is going to depend upon all these ZJs out here, and also, so I want the probability of this event, and that also gamma goes, or gamma intersects this slit. And this slit itself is going to be, as before, at the point Z, and it's going to have a length epsilon and an orientation theta. Okay, so I want to understand how this probability depends upon z and epsilon and theta. And we want to, as I said, really multiply this by e to the minus 2i theta and then integrate over theta. Okay, so what we're actually going to think about is making or obtaining this slit by making a conformal map on a slightly different case where we replace this slit by a disk. So we imagine that we cut a disk out. We've got these other points around there, and we can ask for the probability that this event happens. Let me call this event E. That's whether the curve winds in a certain way around all these points. And that gamma avoids the disk of radius epsilon. Okay, so now we're thinking sort of about the opposite of this, the probability that the curve actually avoids this. We want to do this because we want to use restriction. Now, there is a conformal mapping which is going to map this circle into a slit and preserve the exterior boundary and move all these other points around a little bit. And that conformal mapping is basically of the following form: e to the 2 I theta. There's too many z's. So let me label this plane by w z minus w plus non-singular terms. Okay, so you can easily check that this conformal mapping, actually, if we were in the infinite plane, this conformal mapping, which is singular in the middle of this circle, but that's okay because it's not in the restricted domain, will exactly map the boundary of the small disk into the slit. Because we have to actually add these non-singular terms which preserve the boundary of the whole domain, it doesn't become exactly a straight slit. It sort of gets bent a little bit, but we're going to be interested in the limit when epsilon is very, very small, and to the order that we're working, this is going to be a term which is higher order in epsilon. Okay. So part of the technical problems in the proof is really justifying that you can throw away all these other terms, which I'm sure is true, but you've got to prove it. Okay, so basically then we have, using the conformal invariance property, that basically the probability that this curve avoids here is related to the probability that it avoids the slit. So let me write down an equation which expresses that. Okay, so the probability of this particular event, which depends on all of these points, given that gamma avoids the disk, call it D epsilon, here's the probability of the same event but with these points shifted by this conformal map G, that gamma avoids the slit. Plus, and now because these points have only moved by a small amount in terms of order epsilon, I can write this as the probability of the event at the original points, gamma avoids the slit, plus terms which involve derivatives, so epsilon squared over 16 e to the 2 I theta, sum over j 1 over z minus zj d by dzj. So this reflects the fact that all these other points are going to move around, acting on really this, but to the order that we're working, since there's order already an epsilon squared there, it doesn't matter whether gamma avoids the slit or not. So to this order, this just acts, this just gives us the probability of that event, plus little o of epsilon squared. Okay? And now we're going to use a restriction to write this. Okay, so this is the probability of the event given that gamma avoids the slit. So we can write this as the probability of the event minus this thing intersects the slit, but we have to condition this on this event, on the fact that this, that gamma avoids the slit, which is 1 minus the probability that gamma intersects the slit. Okay. All right. So now the point is, this is small as epsilon goes to zero. This is small as the slit becomes small. So we can expand this out to lowest non-trivial order in epsilon, and we can equate. So we have this, the probability that it avoids this circle is this expression plus this expression here. And now we can multiply everything by e to the minus 2 theta, and we can average over theta. When we do that, the left-hand side gives us zero because the circle doesn't know anything about theta. So what we're basically doing is sort of averaging over the conformal mappings that lead from here to here and give us slits of different orientations. Okay. So when we do that, if we then define Q of the event and Z as being 1 over 2 pi I integral d theta e to the minus 2 I theta times the probability of the event and gamma intersects the slit, okay, then what we've basically shown is that this Q, actually there's this factor pi over 8 that comes in, epsilon squared, and it's related to what we've got here. So what we have is sum over j, 1 over z minus cj d by d cj plus some non-singular terms which enforce the boundary condition, the fact that the unit disk is preserved, acting on p on the probability, acting on the probability of this event happening, which is here, that's this term here, and then there are various terms that come out of this expansion, which is actually just Q2 of Z, the probability of this event happening. So Q2 of Z is just the probability that this random curve goes through this slit suitably weighted by there, not conditioned on this event happening. So that means that that if I define, in some sense, T of Z as being the limit as epsilon goes to zero of 8 over pi epsilon to the minus 2 Q2 at the point Z, then I have an equation which is precisely of this Ward identity form. That is, I have a correlator of an operator which represents this event, which depends on all these points Zj, with the stress tensor, is given by this stuff up here, precisely this term here. So sum over j, 1 over z minus zj d by dzj, acting on the same correlator without the insertion of the stress tensor, plus this term, which gives you a disconnected term, which depends on your geometry. This thing can be zero anyway by symmetry. So what we've shown is that this is that if we look at one slit and various other things happening, look at the probability that this random curve goes through there, we take this second moment of this with respect to the angle, then that object obeys something that looks like the conformal Ward identity, except notice that we've picked up this term here, but we haven't picked up this term here, and that's because the scaling dimension of this operator that tells us whether this curve goes around these points or not is zero. It's just like it doesn't have any scaling dimension. But it's nevertheless the an observable of the curve. So we've picked out at least one observable. Now, this is just the Ward identity with one stress tensor. What we'd like to do, as Friedrich and Werner did, is to look at the Ward identity with lots of stress tensors in. And actually, once we have this formula, it's quite easy to realize how to proceed. We had this random curve which went through one slit, and I said that the description of this event was that it avoided these points in a certain way. Well, just as well, I can actually think about another slit with a point which is labeled by the points Z1 and Z2, and think about this event as being the fact that this curve goes intersects this slit rather than winds around it in a certain way. So the same equation is going to be true. So basically all we've got to do is to take this equation and think about how it depends upon Z1 and Z2, take Z1 approaching Z2, spin this thing around with the correct weighting, and by definition we will get this object Q, which is supposed to be proportional to the stress tensor. And when we do that, in fact, we actually find that T of Z, T of Z1, not Z2, we might have a Z3 and a Z4 there, which also approaches other, and so on, obey the conformal Ward identity, which has got the form 2 over Z minus Z1 plus 1 over Z minus Z1 d by dz1, and so on, acting on the same object without the T in there. Okay, so the the arguments were a little hard to follow, but we can show using restriction that when you have a random curve which obeys restriction, you look at the probability that it goes through or intersects a small segment, you spin that segment, look at this particular spin 2 Fourier component, and that object then can be identified with the stress tensor of the appropriate conformal field theory, in the sense that it obeys all the conformal Ward identities. I've almost run out of time. The question is, what happens when C is not zero? So, in fact, Friedrich and Werner looked a little bit at that. You can, for example, do this by taking an SLE kappa, SLE with kappa less than 8/3, and looking at this at these Brownian bubbles that Vanderlinde talked about, and as long as you tune the density of these correctly, you still get a restriction measure. But then the same arguments that I've talked about would apply. But then the object that you get is not the stress tensor of the conformal field theory. And one way to think, and the reason that it isn't, is that you don't get the central charge appearing, which I've not mentioned here, but those of you who know about conformal field theory will know that when you take the OPE of the stress tensor with itself, you get an extra term, which is proportional to the central charge. And basically the reason is that when you have a single self-avoiding loop, that's all there is in the system. When you've got the ON model or something with another value of C, you've got all these other loops around. And T should really be measuring, should be taking into account all these other loops as well. Now, hopefully with the technology that's being developed now with the conformal loop ensemble, or whatever it's called, CLE and so forth, hopefully we can begin to address those questions and understand where these extra terms come from. In the 2 minutes that I have, I should say, going back to the calculation that I've erased, you can ask what happens if you don't take the spin 2 components. So suppose you take an SLE, ask for it to go through a slit, the probability for it to go through a slit at a certain angle theta. So this is an SLE kappa now. And instead of taking the spin 2 component, you take the spin n component. And this gives you a function of this z here, and you ask for what values of kappa is this holomorphic. And the answer is kappa equals 8 over n plus 1. So for n equals 2, spin 2, we get 8/3. For n equals 1, which is like a vector current, we get kappa equals 4. And that's basically because this is the current which is flowing around the level lines of your Gaussian field. More interestingly, I think, if you take n equals 1/2, spin 1/2, then you get 16 over 3, which is the alternative description of the Ising model. And in fact, what's basically happening for kappa 16, SLE 16 over 3, is that there's an Ising fermion which is flowing along here. So this is a way of understanding the Ising model, which would be very interesting to analyze a bit further. Okay, thank you.